MacCast, Tuesday, January 2nd, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast, the first MacCast of 2018. Happy New Year. I hope you had a wonderful and safe New Year. I hope you also had a wonderful holiday and got all of the Apple Mac gear and other accessories and technology on your list that you wanted. I had quite a quiet holiday here, not too much new tech. I already had my new iPhone 10, so I got my tech for the year. But hopefully you got something nice, maybe a new iMac Pro. We're going to talk about those here in a bit. I do want to start off the show just by saying something that I like to do every year, and that is to say thank you to you for being a listener, a supporter of the MacCast. The way this thing works is it's really a community podcast. I've always said that. I rely on your feedback, your questions, your comments to create content for the show. It's really our show. We do it together. And without you downloading and listening to the show, obviously there wouldn't be a show for me to do. So I am incredibly appreciative every year at the end of the year when I look back and see all of the episodes that we've done and you've listened to and participated in. And I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. I also want to say an extra special thank you to all of you who support the MacCast directly with your donations and pledges through Patreon, patreon.com/MacCast. That goes right back into me being able to create the show, to pay for the bandwidth, the hosting, equipment, gear, all of the underlying business stuff that I have to take care of, including insurance and all the day-to-day stuff. This is my business. It's a business for me, and you're helping me cover it, that, and not only that, but also just support me in doing the show and bringing the podcast to you. So I'm incredibly appreciative of that as well. So thank you to everyone for all you did in 2017 for the show, and I'm looking forward to an awesome 2018. And speaking of 2018, we have a lot of great stuff to talk about. We're going to get into what happened with iPhone sales, and specifically iPhone sales over the holiday. There's a little debate and kind of different numbers being thrown around, and we'll just try and decipher exactly what that means. Possible new features for Apple Watches. We're going to talk about iMac Pros. We're starting to get some early benchmarks and impressions now that those are landing on people's desks and in people's hands. Apple's started shipping them out. You can even maybe walk into an Apple store and pick one up. We're going to talk about that a little bit. And we're going to get more into the whole Apple battery gate thing. And there's some good news for you if you need a new battery for your iPhone. So we're going to talk about all of that. And then we're going to get to a lot of your feedback. We're going to follow up on the whole bookmark syncing thing and talk about your experiences, positive experiences with Apple support. They've been taking a little bit of a beating lately, from myself included. So we're going to get into some more positive stories there. I have a tip on moving your notes if you've changed your iCloud account. We're going to talk about dealing with some malware stuff, and I'm going to give you some of my favorite things of 2017. Not all stuff that just came out in 2017, but just the stuff that I was really using and enjoying in 2017, and I'm probably going to ask you to add to that list as well. So I don't think we'll delay. We're just going to jump right into the latest Apple news, or I guess the Apple news for the end of the year, beginning of the year, starting off with 2017 iPhone sales. As we closed out 2017, I think there was a lot of confusion if you were reading up on this stuff and debate from multiple sources on just how well Apple did selling iPhones, specifically all those new models. You know, where did the iPhone 10 fall in terms of Apple's numbers? Is the iPhone 10 doing well? Have we started the new quote-unquote super cycle that Apple would want for iPhones? And I think because Apple decided not to launch just one new flagship iPhone model this year, but really three if you include the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 8 Plus, I think it made the numbers and just this debate in general a little bit muddier. It's kind of hard to tell and really understand how iPhone is doing for Apple, because you have to understand what was Apple hoping for? And we don't really know exactly what Apple was looking for in terms of iPhone. Even though Apple hasn't announced the official numbers, and they won't when they actually do, they're not going to break down exactly how many iPhone 10s versus iPhone 8s versus iPhone 8 Pluses or even 7s they sold. So it's going to be a little bit harder to figure out things. But that definitely doesn't stop investors and researchers and analysts from taking a guess at what was going on. And we have a couple of those numbers now. Consumer Intelligence Research Partners looked at a breakdown of iPhone sales 30 days after the launch of the iPhone X, and this is how they saw things breaking up. They said the iPhone X captured about 30% of iPhone sales in that period, that the iPhone 8 Plus was about 17%, the iPhone 8, surprisingly, 23%. And I say surprisingly because we've often heard that the larger size phones are the more popular ones, but that may have been thrown off a little bit by the fact that Apple released the iPhone X. So a little shift in the numbers there. And then with the iPhone 7, 7 Plus combined, that nabbed about 20%. And for me, it's kind of hard to know what to make of these numbers. Some feel they're not very positive because it shows that just about a third of the total sales of iPhones went to the iPhone X, pointing to the fact that maybe iPhone X sales are a little bit disappointing, that people are opting for other models rather than Apple's new top-of-the-line flagship model. But I'm not really sure I would actually read it that way. You know, seeing that basically iPhone X captured about 30%, the iPhone 8 Plus, that combined was 40%, and then iPhone 7 nabbing 20%, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, for one, iPhone 10 sales, they're only capturing, you know, 30 days after that. So iPhone 8, 8 Plus had been out for a little bit longer. It's also more competitively priced, I think, for a lot of people. I think, to me, it makes sense that Apple would sell more of the iPhone 8 Plus and 8. It has a lot of new features, a lot of the same features as the iPhone 10, including things like the wireless charging. So I think consumers responded very well to that model. And I'm not convinced that Apple was really thinking that the iPhone 10 was suddenly going to take over for all of the other models that they had on the market. I think a nice sort of what looks like to me, even division of iPhone sales, 30%, you know, 40%, 30%, 20%, that seems pretty good. Now, as for how the actual holiday season went, there's a lot of debate about that as well. We got the latest analytics, latest data rather, from Flurry Analytics, and they claimed that about 44% of all smartphone and tablet activations over the holiday period went to Apple, and they were actually looking at the week leading up to Christmas. So to me, that confuses the numbers a little bit, but here's how they broke it down. iPhone activations went like this, they said. So just now looking at iPhones. So 44% of all smartphone and tablet activations going to Apple. But just looking at iPhone, this is how they saw iPhone activations going. 15.1% for iPhone 7, 14.9% for iPhone 6. And if you're a little bit confused about that, I'll explain that in a minute. Also, iPhone 6S, as you'll see here in a moment. But then followed by 14.7% for iPhone X, 12.6% for iPhone 6S, 10.4% for iPhone 7 Plus, iPhone 8 Plus got 8.7%, and then iPhone 8, 8.1%. So if you combine these into the different models, iPhone 6, iPhone 7, iPhone 8, and iPhone 10, it basically ends up looking like the iPhone 6 was the big winner for the holiday period with 27.5% of total activations. That would be followed by the iPhone 7 with 25.5%, iPhone 8s with 16.8%, and then finally the iPhone 10 with 14.7%. And as I mentioned, if you're wondering why iPhone 6 is in here at all, because Apple's not selling that, at least in most markets, you have to remember they relaunched the iPhone 6 in price-sensitive markets in 2017. So I would actually argue that the iPhone 6 activations being high over the holiday period is probably a pretty positive thing, showing that Apple is selling well, selling iPhones well in those price-sensitive markets. And if we're looking even deeper, it means that Apple's newest offerings of phones accounted for about, again, 30% of the total models, followed by the two-year-old iPhone 6 models that garnered almost 30% of the activations, and then the iPhone 7 with 25% of the activations. So again, a very even distribution of the various models of iPhones. Now, those were the numbers from Flurry Analytics. Loyalytics also looked at activations over the Christmas weekend, so the weekend immediately following Christmas, to try and see, you know, who was the winner in terms of activations for holiday phones, phones given out as Christmas presents, holiday presents. They claimed the Pixel 2 and the 2 XL from Google, those were the top holiday winners. They got 38.61% and 31.4% of the activations, respectively. Then Loyalytics said iPhone 10 saw 28.72% of smartphone activations, followed by the iPhone 8 with 17.7%, and then the iPhone 8 Plus with 13.98%. Now, compare that to the Loyalytics numbers from over Thanksgiving weekend, where the iPhone 10 actually edged out the Pixel 2 with 47% of activations versus 45% for the Pixel 2. And they're arguing, well, iPhone 10 sales didn't go so well over the holiday period, at least for the Christmas period. They did well in Thanksgiving. And again, I think if we back away from that, we can kind of understand maybe what happened there. The iPhone 10 had come out just there in, you know, right before the Thanksgiving weekend sales. So a lot of people jumping in on the iPhone 10 then, still sold well through the holiday period, but Pixel 2 just edged it out for some reason, probably because of a lot of holiday promotional pricing that was offered for the Google phones, something that Apple doesn't participate in. So, you know, when you're looking at these things, it's really, again, hard to suss out exactly what's going on here and to draw a lot of the conclusions that a lot of the articles were trying to conclude, which is iPhone 10 sales are going bad, Apple's not reaching the super cycle with the iPhone, this all looks bad for Apple. I don't think that's really the case. I think Apple is selling a heck of a lot of phones, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. Before we do that, though, I also want to mention some numbers that came from GBH Insights in a list of the best-selling tech for 2017 that was compiled for USA Today. They seemed to show that the iPhone completely obliterated all other technology products for 2017 in terms of unit sales. They estimated that the iPhone sold 223 million units, gaining the top slot in their survey. That was followed by Samsung with the Galaxy S8 and Note 8 combined with 33 million in the number two slot. Now, right away, you maybe see a problem with this, these numbers. They lumped all of the iPhone models together. So no matter which iPhone model was sold, they put those all in a single unit. For Samsung, they only combined two of the Samsung phones, not all of the Samsung phones. So I'm not really sure why they made that distinction. But then Apple Watch also made the list at number four with 20 million units, just behind the Amazon Echo Dot at 24 million units. And Amazon was very proud of their holiday sales for Echo and the Dot. They did really well. But once again, they're only looking at the Amazon Echo Dot, not all Amazon Echo products together. So the numbers don't seem to be a fair apples-to-apples comparison. And I would say, finally, this list becomes even more questionable if you realize they didn't include the iPad in there or any other tablets, as near as I can tell. I don't know if they would have made the number, you know, made the list or not. But Apple sold probably, we know, at least 30 million iPads up through the third quarter of 2017. And factoring in estimates for the fourth quarter, it's probably safe to say Apple sold 10 million plus iPads. So you're looking at 40 million iPads in 2017, which would put it in this list at the number two slot behind the iPhone and ahead of the Galaxy S8 and Note 8. So a really weird list, and I don't know how they could have claimed the iPhone as the top selling tech product. With 222 million units, it probably was. They were probably safe at the number one slot, but just the other rankings didn't seem to make any sense. So all this in a way of saying, you know, when you see these reports and numbers, it's really hard to know what it all means or what to believe or does any of this really matter? And I kind of looked at it from that perspective, and the conclusion I came to was that one thing was pretty clear. Apple still sells a crud ton, and I think that's the technical term, right? A crud ton of iPhones. It is a massively, dominating the market product. As a whole, they do seem to dominate the smartphone market, at least when it comes to activations by manufacturer. Again, I couldn't find hard numbers for the total number of all Samsung phones, and I think you'd kind of have to separate, flip phones from smartphones if you really want to compare, iPhone to the best-selling Android phone from a single manufacturer. But all in all, Apple is really coming out on top when it comes to phones with the iPhone, and overall, that seems to be good. And I think them having an even mix when it comes to selling new and older phones, I think that's ultimately a good thing. I don't know that they need to be selling, more iPhone 10s than any other model by a wide margin to be considered, to have it be considered that iPhone is doing well or not doing poorly, as a lot seem to want to draw from that. And the problem is, I guess it depends on your perspective or your perception, and even more importantly for you to realize that it just depends on the story that you want to tell. If you want to tell the story that iPhone sales are going bad, well, then you look at, iPhone 10 not being the top-selling iPhone in Apple's lineup, and you can tell that story, right? So some would worry that not selling new devices means that people are possibly losing interest in your newest products. Maybe, I don't think people are losing interest in iPhone. I think you look at the whole and see that iPhone 8, 8 Plus, 7, 7 Plus, iPhone SE even, all of these are filling needs for certain consumers in Apple's lineup, and the iPhone 10 hits a certain kind of consumer in Apple's lineup. The person who wants to have the latest and greatest at the top of the line and is willing to pay premium for that. You also could look at the numbers and go, well, Apple makes a much wider margin. They make a lot more profit on those older devices. So by selling older devices, they are actually doing better because they're going to make more money on those. And then finally, the biggest thing for me coming out of this is that overall, more people even buying older phones means more customers in the Apple ecosystem, and that is ultimately really good for Apple's other products and services. We get halo effect, we get massive growth over the past few years in services like iCloud and Apple Music, and all of that revenue is bringing good money to Apple's bottom line. So all of this, Apple selling any iPhones, let alone a majority of devices in the smartphone market, is ultimately really, really good for Apple. So overall, I'm thinking it's very positive. Analysts and Wall Street seem to be pretty bullish on Apple at this point, so I don't think we have to worry about too much, despite, again, often seeing, especially at the end of the year, the reports and rumors echoing or I guess predicting Apple's doom. Everybody's always looking for Apple to fail in the new year. Luckily for us, that never seems to really come to fruition, and we reach the end of the year and the numbers look great, and I think 2017 is no exception. Last week, we mentioned some rumors about a possible EKG feature coming to a future Apple Watch. This week, we got some more rumors about possible new features coming to the Apple Watch. And actually, this one is one that has been rumored on numerous occasions in the past, and that is a non-invasive glucose reader for monitoring your blood glucose level. This comes from a recent New York Times piece that claims that Apple is continuing research into the feature, citing two sources familiar with the project. This is something that reportedly came about when Steve Jobs was having his health issues. He was having to monitor his glucose, and he was not enjoying the process of having to do injections or finger pricks, rather, and asked the team to kind of look into this as a feature for the Apple Watch. And right now, it seems like they're developing research on what would be maybe a first-party accessory that would use tiny sensors that would actually pierce the skin. So I'm not sure how that is considered non-invasive, I guess, if they're small enough. But they would pierce the skin and then be able to track blood sugar levels and return data wirelessly back to your Apple Watch. There's also also been rumors that they've been trying to work out a way to actually maybe build this into the watch itself. But I really wouldn't get your hopes up on seeing this feature anytime soon, because for the piece, the New York Times also spoke to industry experts who claimed that any kind of commercial solution around this kind of technology is actually years away from hitting the market. And in the past, we have heard about the various stumbling blocks that Apple has run into in incorporating this kind of technology into the Apple Watch. To build a non-invasive glucose reader presents some pretty big challenges. The biggest one being that right now it looks like the technologies, a lot of the technology for doing this isn't really reliable. They don't get consistent results. So that's a problem. It has to kind of be rock solid, especially when you're talking about, you know, this critical of a health feature. Also, many of the solutions would negatively impact the size of the device and potentially the battery life. So you can't have, the Apple Watch getting larger or battery life being reduced, which may be one of the reasons why they're looking at this as a accessory to the Apple Watch rather than built into the Apple Watch itself. And finally, and I think likely the biggest issue, is that any solution would possibly require some form of FDA approval. And that is something that Tim Cook has repeatedly come out in public and said that Apple would want to avoid for their products, because it would slow down their ability to innovate and develop and launch and release new features for products. So to have to constantly go through FDA approvals for technology, you know, for stuff built into their technology, that would just be too oppressive for the release cycle. So, you know, all these things kind of factor into what Apple would be able to do. And again, I think that's why a lot of the new features may come out as accessory products, something that maybe they are willing to delay or have to put through an FDA approval process, and then they can release when they do get those approvals. And I think that's a better way to go, again, because especially with health features, a lot of them are going to be very specific, and you know, not everybody maybe needs a glucose reader for their Apple Watch. And the ability to sort of mix and match and add the features that you need, I think could be a nice little enhancement for future versions of the watch. And kind of speaking of future enhancements, apparently Apple also this week, or it came out, I guess they didn't do it this week, but it came out that they had filed for a Connect to Apple Watch figurative trademark in at least three different international classes. And what this is it looks like it's a new logo. It's got a little runner icon, the Apple Watch kind of running guy icon, either in a white or a green circle. And speculation is it's going to be a logo that would be used to designate third-party products that offer official integration with the Apple Watch. So for an example where you might see this logo start to show up is on the new gym equipment that Apple released GymKit for. That's the thing that allows the gym equipment to directly talk to your Apple Watch and relay back health data and exercise data as you're working out at the gym. So you could very likely see a Connect to Apple Watch logo mark showing up on official equipment that supports that feature. So it looks like Apple may be rolling forward with that. And then finally, somewhat Apple Watch related, but also just generally Apple product related, is true wireless charging may be one step closer to being an actual possibility. You may remember the company Energys and their Watt Up system. It was something that they showed off at CES last year, and we talked about it a little bit. But when they were showing off that wireless charging system, while it was working, they showed it to some of the press and they were able to see it actually functioning. The issue at the time was they did not have any FCC approvals to actually be able to put products out in the market. If you remember, it also was kind of bulky, had a limited range, but they were hopeful at that point that they could get FCC approval. Well, it looks like this year at CES, they're going to be showing off the product again, but now they do have FCC approval for their midfield transmitter, which is able to work at and send power at distances up to 3 feet. So you could imagine having a little sort of transmitter on your desk, and then you would have to have a device that had a receiver. Right now, they have some plug-in receivers that you can connect to, say, a USB port, or I would assume possibly a lightning port, connect that into the bottom of your phone, and you would be able to receive power from the transmitter at distances of up to 3 feet. Of course, the company's hoping to work with Apple and other companies to actually integrate the technology directly into their products. But we'll have to see how it goes for them at CES. But there were a lot of rumors, if you remember last year, that we talked about that Apple was already in contacts with Energous. They were very interested in this technology and potentially rolling it into future iPhones. I think there's also potentially a possibility, if this really works and works well, that Apple could just go in and try and purchase the company outright and incorporate the technology into their iPhones. As far as my excitement around quote-unquote true wireless charging, you know, 3 feet of distance, that sounds pretty good, but you still have to kind of have some sort of transmitter. I guess it would be neat if it could be integrated into other household products. I mentioned at one point, you know, maybe it's built into the base of your lamp that sits on your table, and then when you set your iPhone or down or have your Apple Watch near that lamp, it's going to be transmitting and getting a nice little top-up charge from that device. I guess that would be pretty cool. They also had bigger transmitters that could go up to about 10 feet, but if you remember, they were about the size of a soundbar speaker that would go on your TV. So a pretty large transmitting device that would have to send out that signal. And I know they also have some very near-field ones that almost work like the contactless chargers that we have now. So still, the technology is coming. It's been around for a while. It's looking like it's one step closer to actually being in a consumer product now. The question is, will we see it in some sort of future iPhone in 2018? Maybe not 2018, but I'm thinking maybe by 2019 we'll actually have quote-unquote true wireless charging. So iMac Pros are arriving in customers' hands, and we're starting to get details on how well they perform relative to some of the quote-unquote older models, the non-Pro models like the iMac 5K. And we're also starting to get some general opinions on the new machines. Overall, I would say the buzz is extremely positive, and as far as performance goes, they are, and I think this is no surprise to anyone, kind of screamers when it comes to certain kinds of tasks. Almost all the reviews seem to mention that they are incredibly gorgeous with the new space gray finish and the space gray accessories. Also that they are extremely quiet in terms of very little fan noise. I've talked to some people who've had a chance to sit down with one, and they say you almost have to stick your ear right next to the vent, even when it's running under load, to kind of hear any sort of fan noise. And as far as performance goes, it looks like for most video rendering jobs, which is a big task, I think a lot of people would want an iMac Pro 4, the numbers I'm seeing seem to indicate anywhere between a 30 to 60% improvement in terms of rendering times. So, you know, if it took 5 minutes on an iMac 5K, the iMac Pro can probably do that same rendering in about half the time. So doing very well. The question becomes, is it worth the extra price tag? $5,000 for the base model, $5,000 US for the base model of the iMac Pro. Is that time savings enough? And I think for some people, it actually would matter. You know, time is money, and you could presumably save enough money in rendering time to actually justify the cost. Now, when it comes to raw benchmarks, it looks like the configuration of the iMac Pro that you get really matters, especially on the single core scores. Since the new iMacs are clocked slightly lower, there are actually situations where the 5K iMac can edge out the new iMac Pro in the single score numbers. But they cannot touch the iMac Pro, it looks like, when it comes to multi-core. Taking a look at something like the 10-core iMac Pro, it can get a 35,000-plus score on Geekbench. The nearest non-Pro iMac in the 5K lineup, its multi-core score at best is just slightly north of 19,000. So it's really, you know, a pro machine. It's tuned to those applications where you're going to be doing multi-core stuff and really maxing out and accessing all those cores that you have available. Now, something interesting about that is Apple Insider did some testing looking at just the thermal benchmarks of the iMac Pro. How does it run when it starts to heat up, really get under load and start working? And how does that relate to the noise and the fan speed? Because so many people were commenting on how quiet it was, it seems like the fans never really spin up even when it's at max load. And what Apple Insider found was something pretty interesting. They basically noticed that as the CPU would heat up, rather than the fans kicking in and speeding up, the iMac appeared to just throttle down the boosted CPU numbers. So we're not talking about the base raw CPU scores, but the Turbo Boost, which can go up to, I think, about 4.2 gigahertz, which what they noticed was that it would run at about 3.9 gigahertz max. And then when the temperature on the CPU would come up to about 93 degrees Celsius, it would then, instead of spinning up the fan a lot faster to provide cooling, it would simply just throttle back the max CPU performance just for a little bit, down to about 3.6 gigahertz, till the temp came back down to about 92 degrees Celsius, and then it would ramp right back up to the higher performance speed. And then when it heated up again, it would come back down, and it would kind of cycle through that back and forth. They noticed a similar thing when they maxed out both the CPU and the GPU for extended periods of time. At that point, they could get the fans to start to speed up to like the max speed, and they noticed that the sound level and the noise level seemed similar to a 2017 5K iMac, but with just a deeper tone. And when the full CPU and GPU tests were going, the Turbo Boost throttling was a little bit more severe with the iMac that they had, which I believe was a base model iMac, maxing out at about 3.63 gigahertz, and then for cooling it would dip down to about 3.36 gigahertz. They did note on the GPU that the temperature of the GPU never got above 74 degrees Celsius, which is incredibly cool. That was even when they were maxing it out under max GPU load for an extended period of time. So Apple seems to have done a pretty good job with the thermal dynamics in here. One thing that they noted was that, once again, Apple is kind of taking control over how this stuff works and not really offering to the pro user the ability to say, no, you know, I don't mind the fan noise. Go ahead and let the fans speed up, provide the cooling that I need, and don't throttle down my CPU to compensate. Right now, you don't have that kind of manual control. A lot of the fan speed apps, they noted, are not currently working with the iMac Pro, so it's hard to tell exactly what's going on with the fans, but it does seem that Apple has opted for CPU throttling rather than ramping up the fans and bringing more noise into the system, and that may or may not upset some people. They also noted that this scenario, just to be clear, where you max out both the CPU and the GPU for an extended period of time, that's very likely never going to happen, even in high-end pro use. For example, you can edit and render red 8K raw video and not create this situation. So you can both be editing and rendering it at the same time, and you're not going to max out both the CPU and the GPU in the iMac Pro. So that seems to be what's going on in terms of performance and the whole thermal profile of the iMac. Of course, another thing that you maybe would have expected to happen is a teardown. We have received teardowns both from OWC and iFixit at this point, and both have noted some very interesting things with regard to the iMac Pro, including the possibilities for future upgrades. Apple has already stated that the memory in the iMac Pro can be upgraded after it leaves the factory, so you don't have to buy it fully spec'd out, but it can only be upgraded either by Apple or by an Apple-authorized service center. So it wasn't too surprising when OWC pulled it apart that you saw there are memory slots in there. What they did discover is that there are 4 slots, and they are configured with 4 modules. So if you have a 32 gig model, the base model, it's going to come with 4 8 gigabyte modules in there. If you are jumping up to the next level, you're going to have 4 16s, or 432s. And that actually ends up not being too surprising when you remember that the iMac Pro is a quad-channel memory-capable machine. So you're going to want to have equal RAM in the four slots. But it is a little bit of a bummer for anyone who maybe thought, oh, I'm going to get 32 gigs of RAM and I'll have two open slots that I can fill. So I'll have two 16 modules with two open slots. It's not configured that way. You do have to sort of load it in equal amounts. OWC also did discover that the 1 terabyte SSD base model is actually 2 512 gigabyte SSDs in a RAID configuration. One of the articles that I was reading noted that was possibly done for space reasons. The other thing that I thought when I read this is maybe it's also being done for performance reasons, sort of rating that out, I think gives you a little bit better performance in terms of the read-write speeds and things like that. It is worth noting that they did discover that the SSD modules are removable, but they do have a tamper-proof sticker over the screw, so presumably Apple really doesn't want you doing that upgrade yourself, and at this point, there aren't modules available to do those upgrades, but it does potentially mean that a company like OWC or other third-party company could make upgradable SSD modules for the iMac Pro. Of course, all of this with the caveat that you've got to dig in and get in there, which is not an easy process to do. But OWC did mention that they are planning a kind of future mail-in program for RAM upgrades, and they will be selling DIY kits in the future. If you're not faint of heart and you're willing to open up your iMac Pro and probably violate your warranty at the same time, I don't know if I'd be willing to do that on a $5,000 plus machine. But they still note that you probably want to buy and configure your iMac Pro up front with the full amount of RAM that you think you're going to need, because the trade-in value of the 32 gigabyte modules is not going to be that great, and the cost of a full 64 gig or 128 gigabyte kit plus the labor to actually install it aftermarket is going to be prohibitively expensive. It's probably going to end up costing you more to do it after the fact. But what it does mean is that maybe you can get a 32 gigabyte iMac now, and in a few years, when maybe you have the money to afford it, you could upgrade to 64 or 128. So it's nice to know that maybe you have at least the option potentially in the future to add more RAM should you want it and not buy it up front. But the general advice still, buy it right up front. That's going to be the best way to go. They did also note that the CPU does look like it's possibly upgradable, although they don't have any new CPUs to put in it to confirm if it's going to work or not. But in taking it apart, it does look like you can do that. And if you think back to the last episode of the MacCast, I also asked for feedback from any of you who maybe received a new iMac Pro over the holidays, and Jeff wrote in and responded. Unfortunately, he didn't have a ton of time to spend with the iMac Pro before he was off for his holiday stuff, but he did give us some of his first impressions. He said that the keyboard, because of the extended size, can be a little bit daunting. He also noted that the function key, which on Apple's smart keyboard is down in the lower left-hand corner, that has been moved over to the right of the delete key, which can make things a little bit confusing if you're used to using the FN key down in the lower left corner. He noted that the trackpad and the keyboard, for some reason, are not at the same height and angles, and that also they are a little bit flat as they sit on the desk. I'm kind of curious if they're any flatter than Apple's current smart keyboard or smart trackpad. I'm guessing not. I'm guessing that they're at the same sort of flat angle, but there is no adjustment there, so some people might not like that. And he also noted that the keyboard does have the shallow travel, Apple butterfly keys, which some people don't like. Jeff himself said they were perfectly fine for him, though. He noted the cooler and quieter running of the iMac Pro itself. That, again, has been noted in almost every review. Seems to be a general positive thing with the iMac Pro. And he says it's a much brighter display than the iMac that he's replacing it with. He can run it at about 75% the brightness rather than up at 100%. And he did note that it does seem to have better sounding speakers, something that I had heard in other reviews as well, with a lot more bass response in just the built-in speakers. When it gets down to the nitty-gritty, though, of why you would want it, he does say 4K 60 frame per second video rendering, which he uses his iMac 4 with Final Cut, is quote-unquote much faster. I'm assuming he's getting the same sort of 30 to 60% faster render times that a number of the other reviews have noted. And finally, he did say the whole transfer process went pretty well. He just did straight Ethernet to Ethernet from one iMac to the other, mainly because he did not have a Thunderbolt 2 to Thunderbolt 3 adapter to do it over Thunderbolt. So just remember, if you are going to be transferring data from an older Mac that doesn't have Thunderbolt 3, you're going to need that $49 adapter from Apple. Or you can just, you know, pull it back from your Time Machine backup via USB or clone backup. You know, there's so many ways to transfer your data. But if you want to go directly from machine to machine with Migration Assistant, there might be a few things to think about if you're picking up an iMac Pro. And speaking of picking up an iMac Pro, finally, it's looking like they are beginning to show up in Apple retail stores. So you can go online, you can order some of the stock configurations that are available now, and potentially go into your Apple retail store and pick one up. So that is good news if you're in the market for a new iMac Pro. And once again, if more of you are getting iMac Pros, give us some of your thoughts and opinions, some early reviews and impressions. Send those to maccast@gmail.com. And if you want to record a quick 2 or 3 minute audio review, that would be awesome. I'd love to share that on a future episode of the show. All right, finally in the news for this week, we're going to talk about Apple responding to the whole battery slowdown issue in the iPhone, or the slowdown issue related to batteries. Some people are calling it Batterygate. We talked about it on the last episode of the MacCast. Apple published this week an open letter to their website titled "A Message to Our Customers About iPhone Batteries and Performance." And basically, they did a very rare thing for Apple, and they apologized. Now, this has only happened a few times that I can think of. I think they apologized for the whole map thing, and I don't remember if they ever actually apologized for the whole antenna gate, you're holding it wrong thing. I think they might have done that, but don't quote me on that because my memory is fading as I get older. But basically, in this open letter, they said, "We know that some of you feel that Apple has let you down, and we apologize." So direct apology in here. And in the letter, they also reiterate that Apple would, quote, "never do anything to intentionally shorten the life of any Apple product." So one of the allegations, of course, levied when even before Batterygate came out, was that with iOS updates, Apple was deliberately slowing down older devices. And I think this is where a lot of the frustration and anger comes from, because so many of us, myself included, would spout the line that no, Apple is not intentionally slowing down older devices. This is crazy. It's not happening. And it turns out that in some cases, with phones that were having aged batteries, chemically aged batteries, Apple was slowing it down. It started with iOS 10.2.1 and the iPhone 6 models, and then with iOS 11.2, they extended the practice to iPhone 7s, and a lot of people ended up noticing it. And I don't know if Apple just didn't think people would notice, or if it just wasn't going to be a big deal. It only happens under certain situations. It's not throttled all of the time, but it was happening enough, I guess, that a lot of people were noticing, and that's what started this whole issue. So they go on to provide an explanation about how batteries age and why they made some of those software changes in iOS 10.2.1 and 11.2. And it was basically to prevent unexpected shutdowns in phones that had chemically aged batteries when they were operating under conditions where they were maxing out. So what was happening was they would go into the max out mode in terms of the CPU, GPU, and because the battery was weakened, it basically couldn't provide all of the juice that everything needed to keep that running, and that would cause an unexpected shutdown. So what Apple ultimately decided to do was make some tweaks in the software so that when those scenarios were coming up, they would slow down or throttle the CPU, GPU, so that it didn't need to pull as much battery and the device would keep running, albeit at a slower speed. And so another thing that they did in this letter was they spelled out a few of the things that they're going to do to address customer concerns moving forward. And the biggest thing is that they are lowering the cost, at least for a year, of out-of-warranty battery replacements by $50, $50 US. So it's going to be $29 US to get a new battery for any iPhone model, iPhone 6 or later, worldwide through the end of December, through December 2018. So now is a great time if you've been holding off on getting a battery replacement for your older phone to do that, and you will be able to replace the battery regardless of any testing or anything that Apple does. They've come out and said that, so you can just go in if you're willing to pay the $29 for a new battery. They will install a new battery in your iPhone. Now, one thing that's not being talked about, but I'm just going to predict at this point right now, is that Apple is going to have a hard time keeping batteries in stock. So don't be surprised if we start to hear stories about people going in to get a battery replacement and they're having to wait a long time. Now, hopefully what will happen is you'll be able to order the battery. Apple will call you in when the battery comes in stock and then replace it for you, a process that in store takes typically a few hours, about 2 hours. So you're going to have to set aside a window for that. But just know, if you start just walking into an Apple retail store to get a new battery, I'm guessing they're going to run out pretty quickly, because I have a feeling at this price, a lot of people are going to be taking advantage of that. So a few of the other things that they're going to do to address concerns in early 2018, they say they're going to make some changes to iOS that is going to give us more visibility into the health of the battery on our iPhones. Right now, it's kind of really a black box. And that was one of the complaints levied against Apple on this, is like, many of us had no way to know what is the health of our battery. Yes, there's some third-party tools, and we're going to talk about some of those a little bit later, but we should be able to get that information right on the device itself. And then finally, they said they're going to continue to try and improve how iOS manages performance and to tweak what it does to avoid unexpected shutdowns as the batteries age. To me, that sounds like they're going to continue, and they've been pretty open about this. They're going to continue the practice of kind of tweaking and throttling performance for iPhones that have aged batteries, but maybe they're going to improve that a little bit so you don't see so much of a performance degradation. Along with the letter, they also updated a number of their support articles to provide a little bit more insight and transparency into how these adjustments affect performance, specifically noting that when peak performance requires it, they are going to slow down the maximum performance of the CPU and GPU in iPhones that have aged batteries to prevent those unexpected shutdowns. So that's now directly stated in the support articles, but they also added some more insight into some other systems that may be affected in extreme cases, and to give you an idea of what you might experience if your battery has issues, and things like you may see longer launch times for your applications. You might get lower frame rates when you're scrolling, so it might be a little bit more jittery, not quite as buttery smooth. Backlight dimming may happen more frequently, although you can override that in the control center. Speaker volumes may be lowered. The maximum speaker volume could be lowered by up to 3 decibels, which is significant. You know, you're going to get a little bit quieter sound. And you may see gradual frame rate reductions in some apps. During the most extreme cases, they also note that the camera flash may be disabled as being visible in the camera user interface. So if you notice that suddenly you can't turn on your camera flash, that may be a sign or an indicator that there's something going on with your battery, and you may want to have a battery replaced, or at least have your battery looked at. And then also noting that app refreshing in the background might require reloading upon launch if you're in this situation where you have this chemically aged battery. The same support article also pointed out some areas where that are deliberately not impacted. So they will not reduce your cellular call quality or your data performance when you have an aged battery. They're not going to change the capture quality of your photos or videos. They won't tweak or impact your GPS performance nor your location accuracy. They're also not going to mess with or tweak with sensors like the gyroscope, accelerometer, or barometer, and there's going to be no impact on Apple Pay. So all of those areas are kind of sacred and won't be touched or messed with. So this is all good information to know And it's awesome that Apple is giving this transparency at this point. But a lot of people, and I think rightly so, feel like it's a little bit too late. Like the damage is already done. We already know about dozens of lawsuits around the world that have been filed, a bunch of class action lawsuits. And I've heard from many of you that it's just generally frustrating that Apple was doing this at all. And that's completely understandable. Some of you also were not happy with my response to this issue on the last MacCast and felt that I was maybe being a little bit too easy on Apple. And I think for most of you, it came down to this lack of transparency and the breaking of a level of trust with Apple. You know, Apple made changes in iOS 10, for example, that made it impossible for third-party iOS battery apps to get data on things like charge cycles. And charge cycle is one way to tell the health of your battery. You know, Apple rates iPhone batteries for a certain number of charge cycles. So, you know, I had people like Marty who wrote in to say that, you know, it's not that Apple had this nefarious intent in slowing down iPhones. He got that. And that was something that I talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. You know, the fact that they were trying to prevent shutdowns, that's amicable, right? That's something that Apple should be doing. But the problem is they didn't tell anybody that they were making this change, and they also didn't give you the option to opt out of the change. So if you were perfectly okay with the fact that your iPhone might, because it has a chemically aged battery, might suddenly unexpectedly shut down, but you wanted to leave that option so that you could maintain the maximum performance and speed of your older iPhone, you know, he argues we should be given that option. Apple shouldn't be able to come into a device that we purchase, that we own, and change it in a way that affects how it performs without telling us or without giving us the option or the knowledge to know what's going on. And I 100% agree with that. You know, I think Apple did screw up in that case. And I think the letter that they put out is their way of admitting that. Now, is that going to change how they work in the future? You know, one thing that I argued in that last episode, and this wasn't a way of sort of apologizing for Apple, but just saying, hey, this is nothing new. You know, Apple typically doesn't give us a lot of transparency into what's going on in our devices. And in many cases, that benefits us. You know, it adds to the simplicity of the products. It means they're not overly complicated. And they also generally don't give us a lot of custom controls, especially over low-level kinds of things like tweaking performance and stuff like that. They've never really done that before. And so why, you know, my only argument was it wasn't surprising that Apple didn't sort of disclose this or weren't more transparent about this. Now, should they have been? You know, maybe. I think there's a good argument sort of after the fact that they should, now that they got caught. But, you know, if nobody ever really noticed this, would it have really mattered? And ultimately, Apple was, I think, trying to do the right thing, the best thing for customers, which is keep their devices working in a way where they can continue to use them much longer, even if the batteries are starting to fail. And that, again, I think I mentioned in the last episode, is also maybe a wrong tact to take. They should be screaming from the mountaintops, hey, your battery is really degraded and you should really get it replaced. And they weren't doing that either. They were basically making older devices work at a decreased level for longer and not really alerting the customer on how to ultimately fix the issue or problem. And that's kind of probably not the right thing to do either, but it certainly shows that they were trying to actually let people use their older devices, I think, longer than they actually should. So I don't know. It's a tough thing. But if you do have an older device, you can now get a replacement battery for a pretty good cost. And I think Apple is going to be a little bit more transparent about this kind of stuff in the future. And I am looking forward to the changes to iOS so that we can get a little more info on our battery health. But I'm going to give you some tips on that here in a second. Finally, if you have an older device that doesn't qualify for Apple's battery replacement, iFixit is here to maybe help you out. They reduced the price of their DIY battery replacement kits. I'll have a link to those in the show notes at mattcast.com, all to $29 or less. So they're doing a little bit of price matching right now. So if you have maybe an iPhone 5S or a 5 and you want a new battery and you're not afraid to do it yourself, get in there and replace it. They will give you everything you need, including the battery and all of the tools. These are nice little kits, and you know, $29, that is a great price. So if you want to replace your battery in an older iPhone, you may want to take advantage of that. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about Text Expander. You know, it's a new year, so why not treat yourself to a Text Expander subscription, and you can become more efficient with your communication in the year, saving you time and money. I don't know what I would do without Text Expander. I use it all of the time. I have to respond to and reply to so many emails, very often saying exactly the same thing. As you might imagine, I get a lot of the same questions here on the MattCast. And what I've just done over the years is anytime I find that I've answered the same question more than once, so the second time I have to answer that same question, I type it out, I select it all, I copy it, and I use Text Expander's, you know, create snippet from clipboard feature just to create a little snippet. And if I have variable information that needs to go in there, they make it really easy to handle all of that, because I can put in fill-in fields, I can put in optional sections, and just at expand time, when I type my snippet and it expands out with Text Expander, I can do the variants. So it really saves you a ton of time and money. Just think of all the times where you might type the same thing or a similar thing over and over. And you don't even have to think about it sometimes, because actually Text Expander has a built-in way of monitoring what you're typing and can make suggestions when it finds you're typing the same thing over and over again and say, hey, maybe you want to put this in a snippet. And that's incredibly handy as well. But things like email signatures, typical quick replies that you might send in a text, industry-specific phrases or information. If you're in a customer support situation, I know you have tons of areas where Text Expander could help you out. And plus, they have business options and sharing tools, so that if you do have a team that you need to work with, you can share all of your snippets back and forth very easily. It truly is a product that I just can't live without. I have it on every one of my machines. I have it on my iOS devices. And you can pick up a copy for yourself if you just visit textexpander.com/podcast. You can get all of the details and information. And right now, you can save 20% off your first year. There's also a 30-day free trial available if you want to check it out. But I know you're going to love it. So just head to textexpander.com/podcast. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the show. So let's talk a little bit about how you might check the battery health on your iPhone. As I mentioned earlier, unfortunately, there really is not a simple way to do it yet on iOS. Right now, you can go into settings, into battery, and if the health of your battery is bad, you might see a message at the top that says your battery may need to be serviced. Barring that, though, you really don't know what the current state of your iOS battery is. And I did a little bit of research on this. There are iOS apps available in the iOS App Store that claim they can give you battery information. And prior to iOS 10, 2.1, I would say maybe that is true, but with iOS 10, Apple basically cut off battery detail access to all third-party apps. So I wouldn't waste any money on those apps. You can try them out. I tried one of them and it seemed to give me battery information. I just don't know, and I can't vouch for how accurate that information is. So really the best way to get information on the health of your iPhone battery right now is to actually use your Mac. And you can do it in a couple ways. Actually, 9to5 Mac had a really cool little tip on using console.app, using the console application that's on your Mac. You'll find that application in your applications folder in utilities if you've never accessed it before. But it's the thing that allows you to look at all of the log files on your Mac. You can also look at the log files that are on your iOS device. So basically, what you need to do to get the battery information is you need to make sure that you have at some point, probably recently, at least accessed the battery widget on iOS. That's the one that you get to from the control center. So if you go into control center and swipe swipe left to right to access your widgets. If you have the battery widget already activated, you're good. If you don't see the battery widget there, you're going to have to scroll down to the bottom, tap on edit, then tap on the plus symbol next to the batteries widget, add that to the control center widgets, and then tap done. And now you can pull that up. You can see what your current battery status is, not only for your iPhone, but for any connected Bluetooth devices like, say, AirPods or an Apple Pencil if you're on the iPad or something like that. But once you've accessed the battery widget, then what you can do is connect your iPhone to your Mac using the USB to Lightning cable, then open up Applications Utilities Console. So open up the console application, and then inside the console application, you should be able to select your iPhone from the list on the left. And then over on the right top corner in the search box, you want to type the word battery health. All one word, BATTERYHEALTH. And what should happen is you should see a couple of results in the results list. Click on the top results, and you should be able to see your battery health info. You're looking for a little entry that says battery health, and it will then say equals. Hopefully it says good, but if it's anything other than good, it's going to give you an indication of what your current battery health is on your iPhone. So you can do it with the console, which I thought was a cool little trick. But even easier, in my opinion, is to use a third-party app. And there's a couple that you can try out. Coconut Battery is one. That one's nice because it offers similar battery information for your laptop, but it can also give you the battery health of your iPhone. But the one that I like, and mainly because it just has a good visual interface, is iMazing. And I know iMazing has been a sponsor of the MacCast in the past, but here is just another example where iMazing becomes a really helpful tool with a lot of great features. So using iMazing, you can connect your phone to your Mac, again, using the USB to Lightning cable. Select the iPhone, your iPhone, in the iMazing application, and then in the main window down in the lower right-hand corner, there's a little battery icon. If you click on that battery icon, you'll get all kinds of battery data, including the current charge level, the maximum charge level, all of that stuff. And then also you can get the current health of your battery, and it will show you, most importantly, I think, the charge cycles. A lot of the other options do not show you the charge cycles. Now, Coconut Battery will also show you the charge cycles, and that's good. So you can see how many charge cycles your device has gone through. And by the way, Apple says the iPhones should get on average about 500 charge cycles before they need to be replaced. After 500 charge cycles, it will start to get to the point where your battery only holds about 80% of its original charge. And at that point, it's considered time to replace the battery. And typically, with typical usage, that's going to be anywhere from 2 to 3 years of using your battery. So again, and this is on optimal conditions. If you're in a really hot environment, if your phone gets overheated a lot, those numbers can go down a little bit. So, you know, some people in really warm environments might only get 1 to 2 years out of a battery before needing to replace it. So it's good right now that Apple is offering that $29 battery replacement. And then finally, the last way, and probably the best way to check on the health of your iPhone battery at this point, until Apple makes changes to the operating system, is to just contact Apple support directly, either by going into the Genius Bar and having them run a diagnostic, or you can actually contact them through the Apple support site, have them give you a call, use the call me option, and just tell them, hey, I want you to check the health level of my iPhone battery, and they can run a remote diagnostic and tell you how your battery's doing and let you know if you need to replace it. So just a couple ways that you can check your iPhone battery health. I want to do some follow-up to something we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. Listener Brian, you may remember, called in or emailed in, and he was looking for a recommendation for locally syncing the bookmarks between multiple browsers on his Mac. So he had an instance where he needs to use Safari, Chrome, and Firefox, and I think also Opera. I was having trouble remembering the name of the Opera browser. So all those different browsers wanted to sync all that stuff locally. And I made a couple of recommendations, but I also threw it out to the community. And more than one person responded with the recommendation of an app called Bookmaxter. And I'll have a link to this in the show notes at mattkast.com. It's by a company called Sheep Systems. And it looks like it's actually a set of bookmark syncing apps or bookmark apps. There's something called Smarky, which syncs your Safari bookmarks across your Macs using iCloud. There is SyncMark, which is for syncing the bookmarks among the various browsers. They mention Safari, Chrome, and Firefox. Don't specifically mention Opera, so there might be a shortage there for you, Brian. And then finally, Markster, which is a separate bookmark manager and data store that sort of centralizes it. And that was one of my solutions from the last episode of the MacCast, is there's a couple apps that aren't necessarily browsers, but are bookmark apps where you can put all your bookmarks into a central repository and just use a third-party app for all of those, regardless of where you bookmark it, because they all had plugins or extensions for the various browsers. But what looks nice about Bookmaster is that it integrates and syncs across all of your browsers. I'm not sure if it happens locally or through iCloud, but either way, you're going to end up with the same result, Brian. So I think this actually might work for you. Another nice thing about this package is, Smarky, SyncMark, and Markster, the Bookmaster package, is all of those rolled into one product for one price. And it really is the best deal, just $22.95 US. And there is a demo available, so you can try before you buy. But what I was going to say is another nice thing about the package is it also includes some tools to help you find and remove any possible duplicate bookmarks. And you have the option to alphabetize your bookmarks if you'd like to do that, and even alphabetize within folders. So if you organize your bookmarks into multiple folders, you can keep them, you know, some folders alphabetized and others in the order that you want to have them in, maybe more of a manual order. So it looks like a great product. Thanks to everyone who recommended that. And Brian, you may want to check that one out, and maybe some others of you, if you're looking to sync your bookmarks between browsers, Bookmaster. And again, I'll have a link in the show notes at mattkast.com if you want to check that out. Another thing I asked for on the last episode of the MacCast was for people who have had recent positive experiences with Apple, and specifically Apple support and getting support on their Apple and Mac hardware. I had just generally commented that more and more it's feeling like, in many cases, when you go to the Apple store, if you're having an issue with a Mac or an Apple product, that you're kind of having to fight a little bit harder to get the kind of resolution that you want. That in the past, there was a little bit more willingness to kind of put the customer first and, kind of help people out with their products and make sure that they left the Apple store happy with the service and repair that they got. And I heard from many of you that sort of echoed a lot of my recent experiences, which is, you know, ultimately I can get the resolution I want, but I kind of have to escalate to a higher level. I have to talk to a manager. I have to be a bit more demanding. And it just never felt like that in the past that we really had to do that to get the kind of service that we would expect from a company who sells us really premium high-end products. So I asked a few of you, hey, am I crazy? Is this happening to everyone? Got a lot of people who agreed and not many who had a counter experience. So I said, hey, I know there's probably some of you out there who have had some recent positive experiences at an Apple store with Apple support, asked you to send in your comments, and I received a few. And I want to talk about some of those, some great experiences out there. Let's start off with this comment and this experience from Philip.
Hi, Adam. It's Philip from Germany. I wanted to share a quick positive story about my visit to an Apple store. Just a few weeks ago, I went in with my MacBook Pro to get it repaired. What had happened was the keyboard and trackpad had stopped working, and which apparently is due to a little cable getting loose on the inside. And since this is my work machine, I was really reluctant to go in and get it fixed. So I was using it with an external keyboard and mouse for weeks, until I finally got an appointment at the Apple store on a really non-busy day, because I was hoping when I go in that they could do it right away. I went in and they said they can't do it right away. They have to take the machine in, and it can take up to 3 working days, and it can cost up to 90 euros. So I said, you know, what can I do? It's not brilliant, but I was all set up with my iPad to do my work on that. And I went to the office, and you know what? 3 hours later, I got an email saying, you know, the machine is ready for pickup. It's being repaired. So I went back in, excited, and then the person who brought out the laptop said that he also had some other good news that they didn't want me to charge me for the full repair because it was such a small minor thing that it literally took only minutes to repair. That he said they were only going to charge me for the part itself, which was 19 euros instead of 90. Yeah, that was brilliant. I asked why they were doing that, and he said, you know, they just wanted to make me a happy customer. So that's my story. Not everything's bad. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Philip. I really appreciate it. I'm glad that not everything is bad, and hopefully I didn't give that impression with some of my stories. I was trying to avoid that. And I think maybe I actually accomplished exactly the opposite. I felt made people feel like the things were really bad at Apple. I don't think they are bad at Apple. I'm very positive. And most of the time when I go in, I have a great customer experience. It just sometimes feels like things have changed a little bit. So nice to know that there's still those experiences out there. And Philip wasn't the only one that I heard from. Jan wrote in, and he had an issue with a mic on his Series 0 stainless steel Apple Watch. It had gone bad. He brought that in to do a repair. Now, he did have AppleCare on his device, but I would imagine at this point that it was past AppleCare. I don't know when you bought the Series 0, Jan, but he brought it in. He had AppleCare on it, and they just offered him up a replacement. But not only did he get a standard replacement with a new Series 0 Apple Watch, they actually sent him a Series 2 as a replacement. So he got a huge upgrade, and he was extremely happy, as you might imagine. And then lastly, Bob wrote in with what might be my favorite story of them all. He was just doing something simple. He was doing some shopping before Christmas for a Secret Santa gift. They were doing something at his office, and it was in about the $20 price range, but he didn't kind of know what he was really looking for, so he just went into the Apple store, walked back to the back area, was kind of browsing around in the accessories, and a friendly staffer came up behind him and said, "Hey, can I help you find something?" And he didn't really know what he was looking for, but she stuck with him. She offered a bunch of suggestions. Even though the store was really busy and there was a lot going on, she stayed there and waited with him. They went through the products, answered all his questions until he found something that he was completely happy with. And then she helped him check out and go on his way. He ended up with a Mophie iPhone charger, by the way, for about $30. Very nice gift, Bob. That's something I think most of us would be happy to receive as a Secret Santa. But what was awesome was that it was just a small gesture like that of taking extra time with a customer, making sure that they were satisfied. And it obviously meant a lot to Bob, which is why he emailed me. And I think that's ultimately what matters most, making sure that we as customers are happy with our service, happy with the experience that we have, happy with our products. And Apple's always been very focused on that. I think they very much still are focused on that. Occasionally, there's going to be exceptions from that, and they make missteps, and hopefully they learn from those missteps and make corrections. I think this whole battery thing is a pretty good example of that. I think Apple thought they were doing the right thing. They were trying to do the right thing for their customers. It didn't turn out that the customers felt the same way about it once it was sort of disclosed there was a problem. And now they're taking steps and actions to hopefully correct that. And I think that's about the best you could ask for. But I want to thank everybody for emailing in and sharing your stories with great Apple support and Apple retail experiences. I'd love to hear more of them. If you have a story you want to add to this, shoot me an email or send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Andrew recently emailed me with a little bit of a dilemma related to iCloud. He was going through and changing the ID he uses for iCloud. And while turning off iCloud and re-enabling the new iCloud account, he noticed a few things. One, he noticed that it gave him the options to store locally his bookmarks, contacts, and calendars. And then when he re-enabled iCloud, of course, all of those things resynced up to iCloud. But suspiciously absent from that process, he noted, was the option for notes. There was no option to save notes locally. So he was wondering, beyond just going in and using the sharing button and sharing individual notes one by one and sort of transferring them almost by hand from one device or from the one account to the new account, what could he do to sort of mass migrate the notes? And Andrew, I think the issue is that for notes, at least by default, the on my Mac or on my iPhone option is no longer enabled by default. I think if you use iCloud note syncing, it just syncs through iCloud, and that's kind of the only option. But it still is available there as a preference. You just have to enable it in the preferences on your Mac or in the settings in iOS. So what I believe you can do, Andrew, is log into the iCloud account that has the notes that you want to transfer to the new account. Then open up the Notes app and go into Notes Preferences. This is on the Mac, and make sure that you enable the On My Mac account. Make sure it's turned on, and then close the preferences. And now you should be able to drag the notes that you want to move from the iCloud account and folders into the On My Mac area. You can probably just grab the whole folder too if you want to maintain the folder structure. But basically doing that should transfer them from your iCloud area and put them locally on your Mac. So now you should have them there locally on your Mac. And after you've moved them all, you can quit Notes and then log out of your old iCloud account, log into the new one, reopen the Notes application, and then just simply do the opposite. Copy everything, drag everything from the On My Mac area back into the iCloud area, and that should sync them up and get them into the new iCloud account. So that's how I would do it. I kind of looked around to see if there were any really good third-party apps for managing it. I even went to my old favorite, iMazing, and iMazing will let you export the text or export your notes as a PDF. You can also use iMazing's backup system, you know, if you want to back up your old phone and transfer all your notes to a new phone, that works great. But there wasn't really any process I could see for just exporting the notes from one iCloud account and then importing them back into a new iCloud account. I think you're going to have to use the local on my Mac or on my iPhone options enabled in your device or on your Mac to actually do it. And you probably could do this in a similar way directly on your iPhone just by enabling the On My Phone option in the Notes app and following a similar procedure. But good luck with that. I hope that helps you out. Now a little Mac tech support thing that I think many of us, unfortunately, are running into. Hopefully you haven't run into this yourself, but this is something that I run into from time to time, especially with friends or family members who are not as computer savvy as us. You know, they're not nerds. And what I'm talking about is the dreaded, oops, I went to the wrong website and now I'm getting constant pop-ups to call support because my Mac has a virus or has been infected or there's a problem with my computer and I need to run a scanner. I think we've seen these before. You may have seen them if you just pop on to accidentally the wrong website. So it has happened to me before where you click the wrong link, you end up in a wrong corner of the internet and you're on a site that has, you know, like malware and just these annoying pop-up ads that you can't seem to get out of. And I recently read about one of these in a Macworld article, and it's kind of a nasty new variant of this. It's one of the phone number scams where, you know, it pops up a window and it says, oh, you need to call this number right now. And it pretends and it looks like it's from Apple. They even set up a whole support website that looks like an Apple support website. And the idea behind the scam is that, hey, we've scanned your Mac and there's a problem. You need to call us at this 800 number. And it presents an 800 number. Well, the nasty new variant of this that Macworld made note of was a version where they trigger the print dialogue to come up. And then it has a piece of paper that you would print out that has the phone number to call and the information. So it's not just a pop-up window. It's actually the print dialogue. The print sheet comes down and displays that information. And what's really annoying about that is it puts you into this cycle where even if you try and cancel the print dialogue, it will re-pop open the print dialog. And anytime you're with the print dialog, you can't get into the preferences or the setting. You're sort of locked in out of being able to do anything inside Safari. And what particularly nefarious about this is, in this particular case, it also changed the homepage setting for Safari so that if you quit Safari and reopen Safari again, it goes to the same malware page that triggers this print dialog. So you're infinitely stuck into this loop. You may or may not know that typically the big issue with these pop-ups is that when you quit Safari and then reopen, macOS by default has this new option where it will open all of the windows and the browser tabs you already had open. And if it's still on that nefarious website, then the pop-up comes up again and you're stuck in this loop. A trick for getting past that is you can hold the shift key down when you launch or open up the Safari and it won't reopen the windows. So launching the app or any app while holding the shift key down will prevent those windows from opening, and you can typically get past it and then you're okay. If you want to totally change the behavior of reopening your windows when launching an application, you can also go into your system preferences, into the general system preferences, and check the option that says close windows when quitting an app. And it'll go back to the old behavior where every time you quit an app, any windows that you have open will go away. That may or may not be something that you want permanently. So there's also a final trick that you can do when you're in an app and you're quitting it. If you just want to close all of the windows for that one time you quit the app, if you hold down the option key when choosing quit or do command option Q for quit, it will close the app and all of the current open windows. So that's typically a way you can get around the pop-up thing. But as I mentioned with this new hack, the problem was it was changing the homepage settings. So if you went into Safari Preferences General Homepage, you would note that this particular bit of malware changed it. So every time you opened up a new browser window, it went to this bad website that was triggering this print dialog. And so it was very, very hard to get out of it because, again, if you cancel the print dialog, it would just reopen that up in the malware. So you kept getting in this loop. So what was the solution for that? And this is actually a solution that could work for other scenarios too. But if you ever get in this situation where you're stuck on this website that keeps popping up these malware reports, a trick you can do is simply disable your internet temporarily. Turn off your network connection because, again, it has to connect to a website. It has to load a web page. So by blocking that ability to load the web page, you can successfully bypass, get into the settings, change the homepage settings back, and get out of this loop. So, you know, first exit Safari by holding down that option key and then control click on the Safari icon in the dock if it's still there, if it doesn't actually quit, and, you know, force quit it. And then disable your internet access temporarily. Either go into the Wi-Fi settings and turn off Wi-Fi if you use a Wi-Fi connection, or just if you're using an Ethernet cable, physically disconnect your Ethernet cable. Then you should be able to launch Safari, go into the preferences, go into the general tab, delete or change back the contents of that homepage field to the actual homepage you want to use, and then re-enable your internet access and go about your merry way, and you should be able to get past that malware. So this was just something that I ran across this week. It came up and I thought was particularly helpful because I think many of us have unfortunately ended up in this situation, either ourselves or again when we're supporting family members, and you may or may not realize a couple of these things that you could do. So I wanted to share those. Okay, finally for today, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I want to go through some of my favorite things that I discovered and started using in 2017. This isn't a particularly long list, but I'm going to invite you to share some of your favorite things. It'd be ideal if it was an app or something that was released in 2017, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, as is the case with the first thing on my list, which is the application Bear, which is a text editor, and more importantly for me, a markdown editor. Bearwriter.com, bear-writer.com, is a subscription-based app, but I am more than happy to pay the subscription because what it has allowed me to do is sort of centralize all of my markdown and text documents into a single application, and it keeps that synced across all of my devices. Plus, it just has a really great visual style to it. It also applies formatting to my Markdown. So even though underlying all of the Markdown, the raw Markdown text is there, it actually formats things in a way that makes it visually appealing. I don't have to see all of the Markdown when I'm actually working in the editor. And I actually really kind of like that. I can see it if I want to, but it's not always there. And it really is my it's become my Markdown editor, my text editor of choice these days, and I absolutely love it. It's been around, I think, since 2012. It's not a new app by any means, but it's gained popularity, I think, in 2017. That's when I found out about it, and I absolutely love it. So if you're looking for a text editor, Markdown editor, check out bear-writer.com. Another thing that became a very favorite product of mine in 2017, and I know technically it came out December 2016, late last year, and you've probably heard me sort of extol the or give the praises of this product over this past year, and that is my AirPods. They are far and away the favorite wireless earphones that I have ever owned. I've owned other Bluetooth earphones in the past, and nothing can hold a candle just to the experience of the AirPods. And I would say, even for those of you who don't like Apple's earbuds, try the AirPods out. They actually have, I think, a better fit. I think they have a little bit better sound. Are they the best sounding Bluetooth earphones you can buy? I don't know that I would go that far, but I'm not a real audiophile. It's not something that I'm super concerned about. I think they sound great. I think they have great range, great bass response, at least for me personally. But what really puts them over the top is just the seamless usage experience. Whether I'm using them with my iPhone or my iPad Pro or my Apple TV, I can move from one device to another. They're always going to connect. They're always going to sync. I just have to go in and select them either from the control center or like on my Apple TV, as the tip I mentioned in the last episode of the MacCast, just press and hold the play button on the remote, pick the AirPods. In a second or two, they connect right up thanks to that W1 chip, and away I go. I'm just listening, and I have never had a drop. Another feature that I love about them is the battery life and the battery case. I can go days of watching a lot of movies and TV shows and listening to podcasts and music with the AirPods and not have to recharge the charging case. And then when I do, it's just a simple process of plug it in and it charges back up quickly. Another thing I love is because they're not connected with a wire, if I do have a situation where I've forgotten to charge them or they're not fully charged and they start to run low, I can take one AirPod out, put it in the charging case, let that charge back up while I continue to use just a single AirPod. And then when that one in the case is fully charged, swap them out again, charge up the other one, bring that back up to 100%, and then put them both back in and continue watching a movie or listening to music or whatever I'm doing. So the fact that they're purely wireless comes in really handy in that case. And I just can't say enough about them. I know they're a little bit on the pricier side in terms of the price point, but for me, I think it's been worth every penny to have them. I absolutely love them, and I don't know what I would do without them moving forward. If I ever lost one, God forbid, then I would definitely replace them right away. So love my AirPods. I know a lot of you do too, but if you haven't had a chance to try them out, consider them next time you're maybe evaluating or looking for a new set of wireless headphones or earbuds. Another product that I picked up this year that came in very, very handy for me, and I found since buying it, I'm using it over and over again, is my Anker USB 3.0 and eSATA to SATA hard drive docking station. I know it's got a super sexy product name, but despite the name, which is probably my only complaint on this, this is one of these little hard drive toaster sorts of things. And I picked it up when I was having issues with my Drobo. You may remember I had some hard drive issues. I wanted to be able to pop out and easily connect drives to my Mac to be able to run disk utilities and recovery apps and things like that on them to evaluate them, to try and repair them, and the hard drive docking station from Anker came in very, very handy. It was completely affordable. I think it was about $30 US. You can find them on Amazon or on Anker's website. And it's just a super handy thing to have, to be able to have it plugged in, sitting next to my Mac, and to be able to just take a bare drive, pop that into the little toaster thing, have it mount on my Mac, and be able to work with it is super handy. And I think I'm going to actually use it also more and more for my archiving. A great way to archive your devices is, or your files and things like that, is onto external drives. And now, instead of having to buy a full external drive with a power supply and a case and all that stuff, I can buy the little less expensive internal drives, either 2.5 or 3.5 inch drives, pop them into the toaster. I know you can get great little hard drive cases, little plastic protective cases to store internal hard drives in, and just put those over on the shelf. So I'll be able to archive off my files and stuff like that. And having this little toaster kind of thing that I can just pop a drive into and out of makes that incredibly easy to do. So handy little thing to have around. Again, I'm going to have links to all of these in the show notes at maccast.com. Another thing that's not new in 2017, but something that I really started using a lot in 2017 for a lot of my communication and for a lot of the groups that I'm in, is Slack, slack.com. You know, it's kind of, it's something that's a little bit hard to describe. It's a little bit like chat. It's a little bit like Twitter. It's a little bit like Facebook, but all private and specific to a singular channel or group or something like that. So I have a bunch of different Slack channels that I'm in, including the MacCast Slack. And if you'd like to become part of the MacCast Slack, that is something that's available through supporters, people who support the MacCast directly via Patreon. So you can check out patreon.com/MacCast. And at any Patreon support level, you get access to the MacCast Slack. But it's kind of like this nice little back channel room that we can go in and we can communicate directly. So I have a bunch of channels set up in there for the MacCast. There's a Mac help channel, an iOS help channel, and you can get support directly from the community. And because it is like chat, it's pretty instantaneous. And then I have different Slack channels set up for various things and groups that I'm in. So other podcasts that I support, the British Tech Network has a great Slack channel that I am part of. I use it for some of the clients that I work with to keep on top of projects and communications. There's just all kinds of great uses for Slack, and it's something that I really do enjoy and became a pretty big part of my workflow in 2017. So I thought I'd mention that one as well. And then the last thing that I have just fallen in love with and use constantly now in starting in 2017 is the TV app on my iOS devices and my Apple TV. You know, Apple adding that TV app and really aggregating a lot of the movie and TV content that I watch from services like Amazon Prime Video now, and I have to throw that in there. It wasn't as useful until finally here at the end of the year, Amazon added Amazon Prime Video support in the Prime Video app to Apple TV. But now with that and a lot of the channels like the CW and you know, iTunes and all the stuff that is PBS, all these things that are adding support for the TV app, I'm finding the Watch Now feature incredibly useful. It's a great way for me to go through, find new entertainment content that I want to watch, new TV shows, new series, new movies that wind up on HBO or, you know, Amazon Prime. And I'm able to add all of those into a single list and kind of have them in a single place. And now that I'm using it more and more with the various apps, I'm starting to also get additional recommendations that are very specific to the kinds of content that I really love. And it makes it incredibly easy to pick up a show that I started watching maybe on my Apple TV, and then later I didn't finish it for whatever reason, got interrupted. Later the next day, I'll see it there in my up next list, and I can pick up right where I left off as I'm going to bed, sitting down with my iPad. And I am just really enjoying the heck out of that. And it surprised me in a way, because I didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal. My biggest disappointment is Netflix not supporting it yet. I'm really hoping they decide to change that philosophy in 2018. I'm going to be certainly sending in a lot of feedback to them saying that this is how I want to interact with and watch and consume content on my device. And I think for them, at least for me, what's happening is I'm ending up watching more stuff on HBO and Amazon Prime than I am on Netflix now, simply because I'm going to the TV app first and I'm finding content there and watching it there. And because Amazon's not, or because rather Netflix is not part of that, they're getting missed. And it's only after, you know, maybe I don't find something in the TV app that I'll fall back and look and see what's now available on Netflix. So by not being there and by not being up front and in that app, I think they're actually losing a lot of my viewing. And I think they were thinking the exact opposite would happen, that, you know, I would pop into the Amazon app because I have to and then watch more content there. They'd sort of lock me in. It's really having the opposite effect for me. I don't know if that's the same for you, but I'd love to hear your feedback on that. But there you go. That's kind of a few things that had become some of my favorite things or most used things in 2017 that were kind of new to me. I'm sure you have some of these. If you'd like to share them with us, please send me some email comments or better yet, some audio comments to maccast@gmail.com, and we'll try and share some of them on future episodes of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great apps and software by going to smilesoftware.com/podcasts. And if you want to take advantage of 20% off your Text Expander, check out textexpander.com/podcasts. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. I want to get your feedback, your comments. If you have a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. You'll find that at google.com/plusMacCast. And that's the plus symbol. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.